F. They talked about her, in front of her, without including her, as if she had Alzheimer's disease. This position is likely never to open up again in my lifetime, and they want me. I want her to be able to see the twins, said Anna. New York isn't that far, and there's no guarantee that you're all going to stay in Boston. I might be there, said Lydia. Lydia stood in the doorway between the living room and kitchen. Alice hadn't seen her there before she spoke, and her sudden presence in the periphery startled her. I applied to NYU, Brandeis, Brown, and Yale. If I get into NYU and you and Mom are in New York, I could live with you and help out. And if you stay here and I get into Brandeis or Brown, I can be around too, said Lydia. Alice wanted to tell Lydia that those were excellent schools. She wanted to ask her about the programs that most interested her. She wanted to tell her that she was proud of her. But her thoughts from idea to mouth moved too slowly today, as if they had to swim miles through Black River sludge before surfacing to be heard, and most of them drowned somewhere along the way. That's great, Lydia, said Tom. So that's it. You're just going to continue about your life as if Mom doesn't have Alzheimer's and we don't have anything to say about it, asked Anna. I'm making plenty of sacrifices, said John. He'd always loved her, but she'd made it easy for him. She'd been looking at their time left together as precious time. She didn't know how much longer she could hang on to herself, but she'd convinced herself that she could make it through their sabbatical year. One last sabbatical year together. She wouldn't trade that in for anything. Apparently, he would. How could he? The question raged through the Black River sludge in her head, unanswered. How could he? The answer it found kicked her behind the eyes and choked her heart. One of them was going to have to sacrifice everything. Alice, answer the following questions. 1. What month is it? 2. Where do you live? 3. Where is your office? 4. When is Anna's birthday? 5. How many children do you have? If you have trouble answering any of these, go to the file named Butterfly on your computer and follow the instructions there immediately. December. Harvard Square. Harvard. April. 3. January, 2005. Mom, wake up. How long has she been asleep? About 18 hours now. Has she done this before? A couple of times. Dad, I'm worried. What if she took too many of her pills yesterday? No, I checked her bottles and dispenser. Alice could hear them talking, and she could understand what they were saying, but she was only mildly interested. It was like eavesdropping on a conversation between strangers about a woman she didn't know. She had no desire to wake up. She had no awareness that she was asleep. Allie, can you hear me? Mom, it's me, Lydia. Can you wake up? The woman named Lydia talked about wanting to call a doctor. The man named Dad talked about letting the woman named Allie sleep some more. They talked about ordering Mexican and eating dinner at home. Maybe the smell of food in the house would wake up the woman named Allie. Then the voices ceased. Everything was dark and quiet again. She walked down a sandy path that led into dense woods. She ascended via a series of switchbacks out of the woods and onto a steep, exposed cliff. She walked to the edge and looked out. The ocean below her was frozen solid, its shore buried in high drifts of snow. The panorama before her appeared lifeless, colorless, impossibly still and silent. She yelled for John, but her voice carried no sound. She turned to go back, but the path and the forest were gone. She looked down at her pale, bony ankles and bare feet. With no other choice, she readied to step off the cliff. She sat on a beach chair and buried and unburied her feet in the warm, fine sand. She watched Christina, her best friend from kindergarten and still only 5 years old, flying a butterfly kite. The pink and yellow daisies on Christina's bathing suit, the blue and purple wings of the butterfly kite, the blues in the sky, the yellow sun, the red polish on her own toenails. Indeed, every color before her was more brilliant and striking than anything she'd ever seen. As she watched Christina, she was overwhelmed with joy and love, not so much for her childhood friend, but for the bold and breathtaking colors of her bathing suit and kite. Her sister Anne and Lydia, both about 16 years old, lay next to each other on red, white, and blue striped beach towels. Their shiny caramel bodies in matching bubblegum pink bikinis glistened in the sun. They, too, were glossy, cartoon-colored, and mesmerizing. "Ready?" asked John. "I'm a little scared." "It's now or never." She stood, and he strapped her torso into a harness attached to a tangerine-orange parasail. He clicked and adjusted buckles until she felt snug and secure. He held onto her shoulders, pushing against the strong, invisible force willing her upward. "Ready?" asked John. "Yes." He let go of her, and she soared with exhilarating speed into the palette of the sky. The winds she traveled on were dazzling swirls of robin's egg blue, periwinkle, lavender, and fuchsia. The ocean below was a rolling kaleidoscope of turquoise, aquamarine, and violet. Christina's butterfly kite won its freedom and fluttered nearby. It was the most exquisite thing Alice had ever seen, and she wanted it more than anything she'd ever desired. She reached out to grab its string, but a sudden strong shift in air current spun her around. She looked back, but it was obscured by the glowing sunset orange of her parasail. For the first time, she realized that she couldn't steer. She looked down at the earth, at the vibrant dots that were her family. She wondered if the beautiful and spirited winds would ever bring her back to them. Lydia lay curled on her side on top of the covers of Alice's bed. The shades were drawn, the room filled with soft, subdued daylight. "Am I dreaming?" asked Alice. "No, you're awake." "How long have I been asleep?" "A couple of days now." "Oh, no, I'm sorry." "It's okay, Mom. It's good to hear your voice. Do you think you took too many pills?" "I don't remember. I could have. I didn't mean to." "I'm worried about you." Alice looked at Lydia in pieces, close-up snapshots of her features. She recognized each one like people recognize the house they grew up in, a parent's voice, the creases of their own hands, instinctively, without effort or conscious consideration. But strangely, she had a hard time identifying Lydia as a whole. "You're so beautiful," said Alice. "I'm so afraid of looking at you and not knowing who you are." "I think that even if you don't know who I am someday, you'll still know that I love you." "What if I see you and I don't know that you're my daughter and I don't know that you love me?" "Then I'll tell you that I do, and you'll believe me." Alice liked that. "But will I always love her? Does my love for her reside in my head or my heart?" The scientist in her believed that emotion resulted from complex limbic brain circuitry. Circuitry that was for her, at this very moment, trapped in the trenches of a battle in which there would be no survivors. The mother in her believed that the love she had for her daughter was safe from the mayhem in her mind, because it lived in her heart. "How are you, Mom?" "Not so good. This semester was hard. Without my work, without Harvard, and this disease progressing, and your dad hardly ever home. It's been almost too hard." "I'm so sorry. I wish I could be here more. Next fall, I'll be closer. I thought about moving back now, but I just got cast in this great play. It's a small part, but..." "It's okay. I wish I could see you more, too, but I'd never let you stop living your life for me." She thought about John. "Your dad wants to move to New York. He got an offer at Sloan Kettering. I know. I was there. I don't want to go. I couldn't imagine that you did. I can't leave here. The twins will be here in April. I can't wait to see those babies. Me too. Alice imagined holding them in her arms, their warm bodies, their tiny curled fingers and chunky unused feet, their puffy round eyes. She wondered if they'd look like her or John. And the smell. She couldn't wait to smell her delicious grandchildren. Most grandparents delighted in imagining their grandchildren's lives, the promise of attending recitals and birthday parties, graduations and weddings. She knew she wouldn't be here for recitals and birthday parties, graduations and weddings. But she would be here to hold them and smell them, and she'd be damned if she'd be sitting alone somewhere in New York instead. How's Malcolm? Good. We just did the memory walk together in L.A. What's he like? Lydia's smile jumped ahead of her answer. He's very tall, outdoorsy, a little shy. What's he like with you? He's very sweet. He loves how smart I am. He's so proud of my acting. He brags about me a lot. It's almost embarrassing. You'd like him. What are you like with him? Lydia considered this for several moments, as if she hadn't before. Myself. Good. Alice smiled and squeezed Lydia's hand. She thought to ask Lydia what that meant to her, to describe herself, to remind her, but the thought evaporated too quickly to speak it. What were we just talking about? Asked Alice. Malcolm, memory walk, New York? Asked Lydia, offering prompts. I go for walks around here and I feel safe. Even if I get a little turned around, I eventually see something that looks familiar, and enough people in the stores know me and point me in the right direction. The girl at Jerry's is always keeping track of my wallet and keys. And I have my support group friends here. I need them. I couldn't learn New York now. I'd lose what little independence I still have. A new job. Your dad would be working all the time. I'd lose him, too. Mom, you need to tell all this to Dad. She was right, but it was so much easier telling her. Lydia, I'm so proud of you. Thanks. In case I forget, know that I love you. I love you too, Mom. I don't want to move to New York, said Alice. It's a long ways off. We don't have to make a decision on it now, said John. I want to make a decision on it now. I'm deciding now. I want to be clear about this while I still can be. I don't want to move to New York. What if Lydia's there? What if she's not? You should have discussed this with me privately before announcing it to the kids. I did. No, you didn't. Yes, I did, many times. Oh, so I don't remember? That's convenient. She breathed, in through her nose, out through her mouth, allowing a calm moment to pull herself out of the elementary school argument they were spiraling into. John, I knew you were meeting with people at Sloan Kettering, but I never understood that they were wooing you for a position for this upcoming year. I would have spoken up if I'd known this. I told you why I was going there. Fine. Would they be willing to let you take your sabbatical year and start a year from September? No, they need someone now. It was difficult as it was negotiating them out that far, but I need the time to finish up some things in the lab here. Couldn't they hire someone temporary? You could take your sabbatical year with me, and then you could start. No. Did you even ask? Look, the field's so competitive right now, and everything's moving so rapidly. We're on the edge of some huge fines. I mean, we're knocking on the door to a cure for cancer. The drug companies are interested. And with all the classes and administrative crap at Harvard, it's just slowing me down. If I don't take this, I could ruin my one shot at discovering something that truly matters. This isn't your one shot. You're brilliant, and you don't have Alzheimer's. You're going to have plenty of shots. He looked at her and said nothing. This next year is my one shot, John, not yours. This next year is my last chance at living my life and knowing what it means to me. I don't think I have much more time of really being me, and I want to spend that time with you, and I can't believe you don't want to spend it together. I do. We would be. That's bullshit, and you know it. Our life is here. Tom and Anna and the babies, Mary Kathy and Dan, and maybe Lydia. If you take this, you'll be working all the time, you know you will, and I'd be there all alone. This decision has nothing to do with wanting to be with me, and it takes everything I have left away. I'm not going. I won't be working all the time, I promise. And what if Lydia's living in New York? What if you get to stay with Anna and Charlie 1 week a month? There are ways we can work this out so you're not alone. What if Lydia's not in New York? What if she's at Brandeis? That's why I think we should wait, make the decision later, when we have more information. I want you to take the sabbatical year. Alice, the choice for me isn't to take the position at Sloan or take a sabbatical year. It's take the position at Sloan or continue here at Harvard. I just can't take the next year off. He became blurry as her body trembled and her eyes burned with furious tears. I can't do this anymore. Please. I can't keep holding on without you. You can take the year off. If you wanted to, you could. I need you to. What if I turn this down and I take the next year off and you don't even know who I am? What if I do, but after next year I don't? How can you even consider spending the time we have left squirreled away in your fucking lab? I would never do this to you. I'd never ask you to. You wouldn't have to. I don't think I can do it, Alice. I'm sorry, I just don't think I can take being home for a whole year just sitting and watching what this disease is stealing from you. I can't take watching you not knowing how to get dressed and not knowing how to work the television. If I'm in lab, I don't have to watch you sticking post-it notes on all the cabinets and doors. I can't just stay home and watch you get worse. It kills me. No, John, it's killing me. Not you. I'm getting worse, whether you're home looking at me or hiding in your lab. You're losing me. I'm losing me. But if you don't take next year off with me, well, then we lost you first. I have Alzheimer's. What's your fucking excuse? She pulled out cans and boxes and bottles, glasses and dishes and bowls, pots and pans. She stacked everything on the kitchen table, and when she ran out of room there, she used the floor. She took each coat out of the hall closet, unzipped and inverted all the pockets. She found money, ticket stubs, tissues, and nothing. After each strip search, she discarded the innocent coat to the floor. She flipped the cushions off the couches and armchairs. She emptied her desk drawer and file cabinet. She dumped the contents of her book bag, her laptop bag, and her baby blue bag. She sifted through the piles, touching each object with her fingers to register its name in her head. Nothing. Her search didn't require her to remember where she'd already looked. The heaps of unearthed stuff evidenced her previous excavation sites. From the looks of things, she'd covered the entire first floor. She was sweating, manic. She wasn't giving up. She raced upstairs. She ransacked the laundry basket, the bedside tables, the dresser drawers, the bedroom closets, her jewelry box, the linen closet, the medicine cabinet. The downstairs bathroom. She ran back down the stairs, sweating, manic. John stood in the hallway, ankle deep in coats. "What the hell happened in here?" he asked. "I'm looking for something." "What?" She couldn't name it, but she trusted that somewhere in her head she remembered and knew. "I'll know when I find it." "It's a complete disaster in here. It looks like we've been robbed." She hadn't thought of that. It would explain why she couldn't find it. "Oh my God, maybe someone stole it." "We haven't been robbed. You've torn the house apart." She spotted an untouched basket of magazines next to the couch in the living room. She left John and the theft theory in the hallway, lifted the heavy basket, poured the magazines onto the floor, fanned through them, and then walked away. John followed her. "Stop it, Alice. You don't even know what you're looking for."
"Yes, I do."
"What then?"
"I can't say."
"What does it look like? What is it used for?"
"I don't know. I told you. I'll know when I find it. I have to find it, or I'll die."
She thought about what she'd just said. "Where's my medication?" They walked into the kitchen, kicking through boxes of cereal and cans of soup and tuna. John found her many prescription and vitamin bottles on the floor and the days of the week dispenser in a bowl on the kitchen table.
"Here they are," he said.
The urge, the life and death need, didn't dissipate.
"No, that's not it."
"This is insane. You have to stop this. The house is trashed."
"Trash?"
She opened the compactor, pulled out the plastic bag, and dumped it.
"Alice!"
She ran her fingers through avocado skins, slimy chicken fat, bald tissues and napkins, empty cartons and wrappers, and other trash thingies. She saw the Alice Howland DVD. She held the wet case in her hands and studied it.
"Huh, I didn't mean to throw this out."
"There it is, that must be it," said John. "I'm glad you found it."
"No, this isn't it."
"All right, please. There's trash all over the floor. Just stop. Go sit and relax. You're frenzied. Maybe if you stop and relax, it'll come to you."
"Okay."
Maybe, if she sat still, she'd remember what it was and where she'd put it. Or maybe she'd forget she was ever even looking for something. The snow that had begun falling the day before and deposited about 2 feet over much of New England had just stopped. She might not have noticed but for the screeching sound of the wipers swinging back and forth across the newly dry windshield. John turned them off. The streets were plowed, but theirs was the only car on the road. Alice had always liked the serene quiet and stillness that followed a walloping snowstorm, but today it unnerved her. John drove the car into the Mount Auburn Cemetery lot. A modest space for parking had been shoveled out, but the cemetery itself, the walking paths and gravestones, hadn't yet been uncovered.
"I was afraid it might still be like this. We'll have to come back another day," he said.
"No, wait. Let me just look at it for a minute." The ancient black trees, with their knuckled, varicose branches, frosted and white, ruled this winter wonderland. She could see a few of what were presumably the gray tops of the very tall, elaborate headstones that belonged to the once wealthy and prominent, peeking above the surface of the snow. But that was it. Everything else was buried. Decomposed bodies and coffins buried under dirt and stone buried under snow. Everything was black and white and frozen and dead.
"John?"
"What?"
She'd said his name too loudly, breaking the silence too suddenly, startling him.
"Nothing. We can go. I don't want to be here."
"We can try going back later in the week if you want," said John.
"Back where?" asked Alice.
"To the cemetery."
"Oh." She sat at the kitchen table. John poured red wine into 2 glasses and gave one to her. She swirled the goblet out of habit. She was regularly forgetting the name of her daughter, the actress one, but she could remember how to swirl her wine glass and that she liked to. Crazy disease. She appreciated the wine's dizzying motion in the glass, its blood-red color, its intense flavors of grape, oak, and earth, and the warmth she felt as it landed in her belly. John stood in front of the open refrigerator door and removed a block of cheese, a lemon, a spicy liquid thing, and a couple of red vegetables.
"How do chicken enchiladas sound?" he asked.
"Fine." He opened the freezer and rummaged inside.
"Do we have any chicken?" he asked.
She didn't answer.
"Oh no, Alice."
He turned to show her something in his hands. It wasn't chicken.
"It's your blackberry. It was in the freezer."
He pressed its buttons, shook it, and rubbed it.
It looks like it got water in it. We can see after it's thawed, but I think it's dead, he said. She burst into ready, heartbroken tears. It's okay. If it's dead, we'll get you a new one, he said. How ridiculous. Why am I this upset over a dead electronic organizer? Maybe she was really crying over the deaths of her mother, sister, and father. Maybe she was feeling emotion that she'd anticipated earlier, but had been unable to express properly at the cemetery. That made more sense. But that wasn't it. Maybe the death of her organizer symbolized the death of her position at Harvard, and she was mourning the recent loss of her career. That also made sense. But what she felt was an inconsolable grief over the death of the BlackBerry itself. February, 2005. She slumped into the chair next to John, across from Dr. Davis, emotionally weary and intellectually tapped. She'd been taking various neuropsychological tests in that little room with that woman, the woman who administered the neuropsychological tests in the little room, for a torturously long time. The words, the information, the meaning in the woman's questions, and in Alice's own answers were like soap bubbles, the kind children blew out of those little plastic wands on a windy day. They drifted away from her quickly and in dizzying directions, requiring enormous strain and concentration to track. And even if she managed to actually hold a number of them in her sight for some promising duration, it was invariably too soon that, pop, they were gone, burst without obvious cause into oblivion, as if they'd never existed. And now it was Dr. Davis's turn with the wand. "Okay, Alice, can you spell the word water backwards for me?" he asked. She would have found this question trivial and even insulting 6 months ago, but today it was a serious question to be tackled with serious effort. She felt only marginally worried and humiliated by this, not nearly as worried and humiliated as she would have felt 6 months ago. More and more, she was experiencing a growing distance from her self-awareness. Her sense of Alice, what she knew and understood, what she liked and disliked, how she felt and perceived, was also like a soap bubble, ever higher in the sky and more difficult to identify, with nothing but the thinnest lipid membrane protecting it from popping into thinner air. Alice spelt water forward first, to herself, extending the 5 fingers on her left hand, one for each letter, as she did. R, she folded down her pinky. She spelled it forward to herself again, stopping at her ring finger, which she then folded down. E, she repeated the same process. T, she held her thumb and pointer finger like a gun. She whispered, A-W, to herself. A-W. She smiled, her left hand raised in a victorious fist, and looked at John. He spun his wedding ring and gave a dispirited smile. "Good job," said Dr. Davis. He smiled widely and seemed impressed. Alice liked him. "Now I'd like you to point to the window after you touch your right cheek with your left hand." She lifted her left hand to her face. "Pop." "I'm sorry, can you tell me the directions again?" asked Alice, her left hand still poised in front of her face. "Sure," Dr. Davis obliged knowingly, like a parent who let a child get away with peeking at the top card in a game of cards or inching across the start line before yelling go. "Point to the window after you touch your right cheek with your left hand." Her left hand on her right cheek before he finished talking, she jerked her right arm at the window as fast as she could and let out a huge exhale. "Good, Alice," said Dr. Davis, smiling again. John offered no praise, no hint of pleasure or pride. "Okay, now I'd like you to tell me the name and address I asked you to remember earlier." The name and address. She had a loose sense of it, like the feeling of awakening from a night's sleep and knowing she'd had a dream. Maybe even knowing it was about a particular thing, but no matter how hard she thought about it, the details of the dream eluded her. Gone forever. "It's John somebody. You know, you ask me this every time, and I've never been able to remember where that guy lives." "Okay. Let's take a guess. Was it John Black, John White,
John Jones or John Smith. She had no idea, but didn't mind playing along. Smith. Does he live on East Street, West Street, North Street, or South Street? South Street. Was the town Arlington, Cambridge, Brighton, or Brookline? Brookline. Okay, Alice, last question. Where is my $20 bill? In your wallet? No, earlier, I hid a $20 bill somewhere in the room. Do you remember where I put it? You did this while I was here? Yes. Any ideas at all come to mind? I'll let you keep it if you find it. Well, if I had known that, I would have been sure to figure out a way to remember it. I'm sure you would have. Any idea where it is? She saw the focus of his stare deviate to her right, just over her shoulder, for the briefest moment before settling back on her. She twisted around. Behind her, there was a whiteboard on the wall with three words scrawled on it in red marker. Glutamate, LTP, apoptosis. The red marker lay on a tray at the bottom, right next to a folded $20 bill. Delighted, she stepped over to the whiteboard and claimed her prize. Dr. Davis chuckled. If all my patients were as smart as you, I'd go broke. Alice, you can't keep that. You saw him look at it, said John. I won it, said Alice. It's okay. She found it, said Dr. Davis. Should she be like this after only a year and being on medication? Asked John. Well, there are probably a few things going on here. Her illness probably started long before she was diagnosed last January. She and you and your family and her colleagues probably disregarded any number of symptoms as fluke or normal or chalked them up to stress, not enough sleep, too much to drink, and on and on. This could have gone on easily for a year or two or longer. And she's incredibly bright. If the average person has, say for simplicity, 10 synapses that lead to a piece of information, Alice could easily have 50. When the average person loses those 10 synapses, that piece of information is inaccessible to them, forgotten. But Alice can lose those 10 and still have 40 other ways of getting to the target. So her anatomical losses aren't as profoundly and functionally noticeable at first. But by now, she's lost a lot more than 10, said John. Yes, I'm afraid she has. Her recent memory is now falling in the bottom 3% of those able to complete the tests. Her language processing has degraded considerably, and she's losing self-awareness, all as we'd unfortunately expect to see. But she's also incredibly resourceful. She used a number of inventive strategies today to answer questions correctly that she couldn't actually remember correctly. But there were a lot of questions that she couldn't answer correctly regardless, said John. Yes, that's true. It's just getting so much worse, so quickly. Can we up the dosage of either the Aricept or the Namenda? Asked John. No, she's at the maximum dosage already for both. Unfortunately, this is a progressive, degenerative disease with no cure. It gets worse, despite any medication we have right now. And it's clear she's either getting the placebo or this Amylyx drug doesn't work, said John. Dr. Davis paused as if considering whether to agree or disagree with this. I know you're discouraged, but I've often seen unexpected periods of plateau where it seems to stall, and this can last for some time. Alice closed her eyes and pictured herself standing solidly in the middle of a plateau, a beautiful mesa. She could see it, and it was worth hoping for. Could John see it? Could he still hope for her, or had he already given up? Or worse, did he actually hope for her rapid decline, so he could take her, vacant and complacent, to New York in the fall? Would he choose to stand with her on the plateau, or push her down the hill? She folded her arms, unfolded her crossed legs, and planted her feet flat on the floor. Alice, are you still running? Asked Dr. Davis. No, I stopped a while ago. Between John's schedule and my lack of coordination, I can't seem to see curbs or bumps in the road, and I misjudge distances. I had some terrible falls. Even at home, I keep forgetting about the raised thingy in the doorways, and I trip into every room I go in. I've got tons of bruises. Okay, John, I would either remove the doorway thingies or paint them a contrasting color, something bright, or cover them in brightly colored tape so Alice can notice them. Otherwise, they just blend into the floor. All right. Alice, tell me about your support group, said Dr. Davis. There are four of us. We meet once a week for a few hours at each other's houses, and we email each other every day. It's wonderful. We talk about everything. Dr. Davis and that woman in that little room had asked her a lot of probing questions today, questions designed to measure the precise level of destruction inside her head. But no one understood what was still alive inside her head better than Mary, Kathy, and Dan. I want to thank you for taking the initiative and filling the obvious gap we have in our support system here. If I get any new early stage or early onset patients, can I tell them how to get in touch with you? Yes, please do. You should also tell them about DASNY. It's the Dementia Advocacy and Support Network International. It's an online forum for people with dementia. I've met over a dozen people there, from all over the country in Canada and the UK and Australia. Well, I've never actually met them, it's all online, but I feel like I know them, and they know me more intimately than many of the people I've known my whole life. We don't waste any time. We don't have enough of it. We talk about the stuff that matters. John shifted in his seat and jiggled his leg. Thank you, Alice. I'll add that website to our standard packet of information. How about you, John? Have you yet talked with our social worker here or gone to any of the caregiver support group meetings? No, I haven't. I've had coffee a couple of times with the spouses of her support group people, but otherwise, no. You might want to consider getting some support yourself. You're not the one with the disease, but you're living with it too by living with Alice, and it's hard on the caregivers. I see the toll it takes every day with family members who come in. There's Denise Daddario, the social worker here, the MGH Caregiver Support Group, and I know that the Massachusetts Alzheimer's Association has many local caregiver groups. The resources are there for you, so don't hesitate if you need them. All right. Speaking of the Alzheimer's Association, Alice, I just received their program for the annual Dementia Care Conference, and I see you're giving the opening plenary presentation, said Dr. Davis. The Dementia Care Conference was a national meeting for professionals involved in the care of people with dementia and their families. Neurologists, general practice physicians, geriatric physicians, neuropsychologists, nurses, and social workers all gathered in one place to exchange information on approaches to diagnosis, treatment, and patient care. It sounded similar to Alice's support group and DASNY, but bigger and for those without dementia. This year's meeting was to be held next month in Boston. Yes, said Alice. I meant to ask, will you be there? I will. I'll be sure to be in the front row. You know, they've never asked me to give a plenary presentation, said Dr. Davis. You're a brave and remarkable woman, Alice. His compliment, genuine and not patronizing, was just the boost her ego needed after having been so ruthlessly pummeled by so many tests today. John spun his ring. He looked at her with tears in his eyes and a clenched smile that confused her. March 2005. Alice stood at the podium with her typed speech in her hand and looked out at the people seated in the hotel's grand ballroom. She used to be able to eyeball an audience and guess with an almost psychic accuracy the number of people in attendance. It was a skill she no longer possessed. There were a lot of people. The organizer, whatever her name was, had told her that over 700 people were registered for the conference. Alice had given many talks to audiences that size and larger. The people in her audience's past had included distinguished Ivy League faculty, Nobel Prize winners, and the world's thought leaders in psychology and language. Today, John sat in the front row. He kept looking back over his shoulder as he repeatedly wrung his program into a tight tube. She hadn't noticed until just now that he was wearing his lucky gray T-shirt. He usually reserved it for only his most critical lab result days. She smiled at his superstitious gesture. Anna, Charlie, and Tom sat next to him, talking to one another. A few seats down sat Mary, Kathy, and Dan with their husbands and wife. Positioned front and center, Dr. Davis sat ready with his pen and notebook. Beyond them sat a sea of health professionals dedicated to the care of people with dementia. This might not be her biggest or most prestigious audience, but of all the talks she'd given in her life, she hoped this one would have the most powerful impact. She ran her fingers back and forth across the smooth, gemmed wings of her butterfly necklace, which sat, as if perched, on the knobby tip of her sternum. She cleared her throat. She took a sip of water. She touched the butterfly wings one more time, for luck. "Today's a special occasion, Mom." "Good morning. My name is Dr. Alice Howland. I'm not a neurologist or general practice physician, however. My doctorate is in psychology. I was a professor at Harvard University for 25 years. I taught courses in cognitive psychology, I did research in the field of linguistics, and I lectured all over the world. I am not here today, however, to talk to you as an expert in psychology or language. I am here today to talk to you as an expert in Alzheimer's disease. I don't treat patients, run clinical trials, study mutations in DNA, or counsel patients and their families. I am an expert in this subject because, just over a year ago, I was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. I'm honored to have this opportunity to talk with you today, to hopefully lend some insight into what it's like to live with dementia. Soon, although I'll still know what it is like, I'll be unable to express it to you. And too soon after that, I'll no longer even know that I have dementia. So what I have to say today is timely. We, in the early stages of Alzheimer's, are not yet utterly incompetent. We are not without language or opinions that matter, or extended periods of lucidity. Yet we are not competent enough to be trusted with many of the demands and responsibilities of our former lives. We feel like we are neither here nor there, like some crazy Dr. Seuss character in a bizarre land. It's a very lonely and frustrating place to be. I no longer work at Harvard. I no longer read and write research articles or books. My reality is completely different from what it was not long ago, and it is distorted. The neural pathways I use to try to understand what you are saying, what I am thinking, and what is happening around me are gummed up with amyloid. I struggle to find the words I want to say, and often hear myself saying the wrong ones. I can't confidently judge spatial distances, which means I drop things and fall down a lot, and can get lost 2 blocks from my home. And my short-term memory is hanging on by a couple of frayed threads. I'm losing my yesterdays. If you ask me what I did yesterday, what happened, what I saw and felt and heard, I'd be hard-pressed to give you details. I might guess a few things correctly. I'm an excellent guesser. But I don't really know. I don't remember yesterday or the yesterday before that. And I have no control over which yesterdays I keep and which ones get deleted. This disease will not be bargained with. I can't offer it the names of the United States presidents in exchange for the names of my children. I can't give it the names of the state capitals and keep the memories of my husband. I often fear tomorrow. What if I wake up and don't know who my husband is? What if I don't know where I am or recognize myself in the mirror? When will I no longer be me? Is the part of my brain that's responsible for my unique me-ness vulnerable to this disease? Or is my identity something that transcends neurons, proteins, and defective molecules of DNA? Is my soul and spirit immune to the ravages of Alzheimer's? I believe it is. Being diagnosed with Alzheimer's is like being branded with a scarlet A. This is now who I am, someone with dementia. This was how I would, for a time, define myself, and how others continue to define me. But I am not what I say, or what I do, or what I remember. I am fundamentally more than that.
I am a wife, mother, and friend, and soon to be grandmother. I still feel, understand, and am worthy of the love and joy in those relationships. I am still an active participant in society. My brain no longer works well, but I use my ears for unconditional listening, my shoulders for crying on, and my arms for hugging others with dementia. Through an early-stage support group, through the Dementia Advocacy and Support Network International, by talking to you today, I am helping others with dementia live better with dementia. I am not someone dying. I am someone living with Alzheimer's. I want to do that as well as I possibly can. I'd like to encourage earlier diagnosis, for physicians not to assume that people in their 40s and 50s experiencing memory and cognition problems are depressed or stressed or menopausal. The earlier we are properly diagnosed, the earlier we can go on medication, with the hope of delaying progression and maintaining a footing on a plateau long enough to reap the benefits of a better treatment or cure soon. I still have hope for a cure, for me, for my friends with dementia, for my daughter who carries the same mutated gene. I may never be able to retrieve what I've already lost, but I can sustain what I have. I still have a lot. Please don't look at our scarlet A's and write us off. Look us in the eye. Talk directly to us. Don't panic or take it personally if we make mistakes, because we will. We will repeat ourselves, we will misplace things, and we will get lost. We will forget your name and what you said 2 minutes ago. We will also try our hardest to compensate for and overcome our cognitive losses. I encourage you to empower us, not limit us. If someone has a spinal cord injury, if someone has lost a limb, or has a functional disability from a stroke, families and professionals work hard to rehabilitate that person, to find ways to cope and manage despite these losses. Work with us. Help us develop tools to function around our losses in memory, language, and cognition. Encourage involvement in support groups. We can help each other, both people with dementia and their caregivers, navigate through this Dr. Seuss land of neither here nor there. My yesterdays are disappearing, and my tomorrows are uncertain, so what do I live for? I live for each day. I live in the moment. Some tomorrow soon, I'll forget that I stood before you and gave this speech. But just because I'll forget it some tomorrow doesn't mean that I didn't live every second of it today. I will forget today, but that doesn't mean that today didn't matter. I'm no longer asked to lecture about language at universities and psychology conferences all over the world. But here I am before you today, giving what I hope is the most influential talk of my life. And I have Alzheimer's disease. Thank you. She looked up from her speech for the first time since she began talking. She hadn't dared to break eye contact with the words on the page until she finished, for fear of losing her place. To her genuine surprise, the entire ballroom was standing, clapping. It was more than she had hoped for. She had hoped for two simple things: not to lose the ability to read during the talk, and to get through it without making a fool of herself. She looked at the familiar faces in the front row and knew without a doubt that she had far exceeded those modest expectations. Kathy, Dan, and Dr. Davis beamed. Mary was dabbing her eyes with a handful of pink tissues. Anna clapped and smiled without once stopping to wipe the tears that streamed down her face. Tom clapped and cheered and looked like he could barely keep himself from running up to hug and congratulate her. She couldn't wait to hug him, too. John stood tall and unabashed in his lucky gray T-shirt, with an unmistakable love in his eyes and joy in his smile as he applauded her. April 2005. The energy required to write her speech, to deliver it well, and to shake hands and converse articulately with what seemed like hundreds of enthusiastic attendees at the Dementia Care Conference would have been enormous for someone without Alzheimer's disease.
For someone with Alzheimer's, it was beyond enormous. She managed to function for some time afterward on the adrenaline high, the memory of the applause, and a renewed confidence in her inner status. She was Alice Howland, brave and remarkable hero. But the high wasn't sustainable, and the memory faded. She lost a little of her confidence and status when she brushed her teeth with moisturizer. She lost a bit more when she tried all morning to call John with the television remote control. She lost the last of it when her own unpleasant body odor informed her that she hadn't bathed in days. But she couldn't muster up the courage or knowledge she needed to step into the tub. She was Alice Howland, Alzheimer's victim. Her energy depleted with no reserve to draw upon, her euphoria waned, and the memory of her victory and confidence stolen, she suffered under an overwhelming, exhausting heaviness. She slept late and stayed in bed hours after waking. She sat on her couch and cried without specific reason. No amount of sleep or crying replenished her. John woke her from a dead sleep and dressed her. She let him. He didn't tell her to brush her hair or teeth. She didn't care. He hurried her into the car. She leaned her forehead against the cold window. The world outside looked bluish-gray. She didn't know where they were going. She felt too indifferent to ask. John pulled into a parking garage. They got out and entered a building through a door in the garage. The white fluorescent lighting hurt her eyes. The wide hallways, the elevators, the signs on the walls, radiology, surgery, obstetrics, neurology. Neurology. They entered a room. Instead of the waiting room she expected to see, she saw a woman sleeping in a bed. She had swollen, closed eyes and IV tubing taped to her hand. "What's wrong with her?" whispered Alice. "Nothing, she's just tired," said John. "She looks terrible." "Shh, you don't want her to hear that." The room didn't look like a hospital room. It contained another bed, smaller and unmade, next to the one the woman was sleeping in, a large television in the corner, a lovely vase of yellow and pink flowers on a table, and hardwood floors. Maybe this wasn't a hospital. It could be a hotel. But then why would the woman have that tube in her hand? An attractive young man came in with a tray of coffee. Maybe he's her doctor. He wore a Red Sox hat, jeans, and a Yale t-shirt. Maybe he's room service. "Congratulations," whispered John. "Thanks. You just missed Tom. He'll be back this afternoon. Here, I got everyone coffee and a tea for Alice. I'll go get the babies." The young man knew her name. The young man returned, rolling a cart carrying two clear plastic rectangular tubs. Each tub contained a tiny baby, their bodies entirely swaddled in white blankets, and the tops of their heads covered in white hats, so that only their faces showed. "I'm going to wake her. She wouldn't want to sleep through you meeting them," said the young man. "Honey, wake up. We have visitors." The woman woke up reluctantly, but when she saw Alice and John, an excitement entered her tired eyes and enlivened her. She smiled, and her face seemed to snap into place. "Oh my, that's Anna." "Congratulations, baby," said John. "They're beautiful," and he leaned down over her and kissed her forehead. "Thanks, Dad." "You look great. How are you feeling, okay?" asked John. "Thanks, I'm okay, just exhausted. Ready? Here they are. This is Alice and Anne, and this little guy is Charles Thomas." The young man handed one of the babies to John. He lifted the other baby, the one with a pink ribbon tied to its hat, and presented it to Alice. "Would you like to hold her?" asked the young man. Alice nodded. She held the tiny sleeping baby, her head in the crook of her elbow, her bum in her hand, her body up against her chest, her ear against her heart. The tiny sleeping baby breathed tiny shallow breaths through tiny round nostrils. Alice instinctively kissed her blotchy pink, pudgy cheek.
Anna, you had your babies, said Alice. Yes, Mom, you're holding your granddaughter, Alice and Anne, said Anna. She's perfect. I love her. My granddaughter. She looked at the baby with the blue ribbon in John's arms. My grandson. And they won't get Alzheimer's like I did? Asked Alice. No, Mom, they won't. Alice inhaled deeply, breathing in the scrumptious smell of her beautiful granddaughter, filling herself with a sense of relief and peace she hadn't known in a long time. Mom, I got into NYU and Brandeis University. Oh, that's so exciting. I remember getting into school. What are you going to study? Asked Alice. Theater. That's wonderful. I used to go to Harvard. I loved it there. What school did you say you're going to? I don't know yet. I got into NYU and Brandeis. Which one do you want to go to? I'm not sure. I talked to Dad, and he really wants me to go to NYU. Do you want to go to NYU? I don't know. It has the better reputation, but I like Brandeis better for me. I'd be near Anna and Charlie and the babies and Tom and you and Dad if you stay. If I stay where? Asked Alice. Here in Cambridge. Where else would I be? New York. I'm not going to be in New York. They sat next to each other on a couch folding baby clothes, separating the pinks from the blues. The television flashed images at them without the volume. It's just, if I accept at Brandeis and you and Dad move to New York, then I'll feel like I'm in the wrong place, like I made the wrong decision. Alice stopped folding and looked at the woman. She was young, skinny, pretty. She was also tired and conflicted. How old are you? Asked Alice. 24. 24. I loved being 24. You have your whole life in front of you. Anything's possible. Are you married? The pretty, conflicted woman stopped folding and faced Alice squarely. She locked in on Alice's eyes. The pretty, conflicted woman had searching, honest, peanut butter brown eyes. No, I'm not married. Kids? No. Then you should do exactly what you want. But what if Dad decides to take the job in New York? You can't make this kind of decision based on what other people might or might not do. This is your decision, your education. You're a grown woman. You don't have to do what your father wants. Make it based on what's right for your life. Okay, I will. Thank you. The pretty woman with the lovely peanut butter eyes let out an amused laugh and a sigh and resumed folding. We've come a long way, Mom. Alice didn't understand what she meant. You know, she said, you remind me of my students. I used to be a student advisor. I was pretty good at it. Yes, you were. You still are. What's the name of the school you want to go to? Brandeis. Where's that? In Waltham, only a few minutes from here. And what are you going to study? Acting. That's wonderful. Will you act in plays? I will. Shakespeare? Yes. I love Shakespeare, especially the tragedies. Me too. The pretty woman moved over and hugged Alice. She smelled fresh and clean, like soap. Her hug penetrated Alice much like her peanut butter eyes had. Alice felt happy and close to her. Mom, please don't move to New York. New York? Don't be silly. I live here. Why would I move to New York? I don't know how you do this, said the actress. I was up with her most of the night, and I feel delirious. I made her scrambled eggs, toast, and tea at 3 a.m. I was up then. If we could get you to lactate, then you could help me feed one of these guys, said the mother of the babies. The mother was sitting on the couch next to the actress, breastfeeding the baby in blue. Alice held the baby in pink. John walked in, showered and dressed,
holding a coffee mug in one hand and a newspaper in the other. The women were wearing pajamas.
"Lyd, thanks for getting up last night. I really needed the sleep," said John.
"Dad, how on